Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the First Intuition Student Podcast. Tonight, we are talking about tax, and I'm joined with my good friend and colleague, David Malthouse. Good evening, David.
Hi there, Ben. How have you been this week?
Really good. We've had some big exams. It's been the end of lots of hard work for our ICAW students who have had their advanced stage exams this week. We're recording this on Wednesday like we always do. And so the case study, the final endpoint assessment exam, has been today. And we've had a number of our students doing that. So if you're listening to this, guys, I hope the exams have gone well. They're now waiting for their results, which come out just before Christmas in mid-December. But something else has caught my eye in the news today. Dave, have you seen this? Are you a fan of the Nestlé Caramac?
I am. As a child, what my mum used to do in our house is, for a special treat when we had ice cream, is she would get the Caramac, she'd put it in the microwave and melt it, and she would then spoon the Caramac over the ice cream where it would reset in the shape of the ice cream, and it was delicious. So yeah, I have heard the news about the Caramac, Ben.
It's being discontinued, guys. If you've not heard, after 64 years of being on sale in the United Kingdom, it's been discontinued. And my accountancy brain jumped straight to product lifecycle, Dave, when I heard that news today, and thinking it's clearly been in the decline phase for a while and they have finally made the decision to abandon the product.
Well, it's funny you say that, Ben, but when I read one of the news pieces, I think on the BBC website, they said that Caramac has always been a niche product, and there's nothing wrong with a niche product. There's good margins to be made in niche products. But what they'd seen recently is a range of competitors that were selling other caramel-based confections that didn't contain cocoa and caffeine and things like that. So I don't know if there's an element of that competition and rivalry pushing them out of a market because they can no longer get maybe the economies of scale that they need to in order to produce at the volumes they used to.
Potentially. It's certainly a source of amusement in our household. A few years back, I gave up chocolate for Lent. A lot of people give up stuff for 40 days during Lent, and I gave up chocolate. And then, on a technicality, being the accountant I am, read the small print and thought, I can still have Caramac because it doesn't contain any cocoa.
Yep.
My wife thought I was cheating, wasn't really in the spirit of giving up chocolate and broader confectionery. But Caramac, for me, was always my Lent go-to when I was off chocolate.
Well, this goes back to the things we discussed when we talked about ChatGPT. You've got to know exactly what it is you're being asked to do. And, you know, you can't be, you know, you've got to be forgiven for finding a way around those particular rules. You've got to be very specific when you give up things. You should have said you were giving up all forms of confectionery, and then there would be no way to sneak in and get a Caramac. You'd have just had to have a banana.
Exactly. How's your week gone? Anything that's caught your eye this week?
I spent today in the wonderful city of Colchester looking at venues for us to start delivering some classes in the middle of next year. So that will be the third city in Essex that we run classes in. And as you know, Ben, there are only three cities in Essex. So we'll have a centre in all three of those cities.
And if my Roman history from school days serves me right, it was the former capital of England, Colchester, in Roman times.
Absolutely was. And home to a fearsome clan of Essex warriors that the Romans were very scared of.
And now it's going to be potentially home to a fearsome clan of first intuition tutors ready to round up some students to come on our brilliant courses.
Exactly.
We have got a theme tonight. It's not just going to be me and Dave talking about Caramac and Colchester or anything else beginning with the letter C for that fact. We're talking about tax this evening. Myself and Dave regularly have a catch up. What can we talk about on the podcast? From memory, we've not done too much in the world of tax, which actually surprises me now with the number of episodes we've recorded and got out there in the past. Bearing in mind, tax is pretty central to the syllabus, the qualifications we teach. and also to real world businesses and also us as individuals. We're coming at it from a slightly different angle tonight, but I wanted to first off ask, why do we have tax? Not to get too deep and meaningful about it, but what is the purpose of taxation? Dave, why do the UK government, as many governments around the world, have a taxation system in place?
Taxation has been around for centuries, Ben, and the kings of the day, or queens, but we didn't have too many queens, so the kings of the day would usually go to the people of the country and raise money through taxation to fund the things that they wanted to do, which in the olden days tended to be the war. So the King of England wanted to fight a war, wanted to wage a war against France or Spain or Italy. And in order to do it, they needed an army. They needed to pay that army. So to raise funds, they go to people and say, we need to tax you on some of your wealth. They take that money and then they'd use it to fund that thing that they wanted to do. And since then, our kings have become less powerful. Governments have become more powerful. The government provide, you know, more services than just fighting wars and trying to conquer other countries and kill loads of foreign people. Okay, instead, they're raising money for all kinds of things to support the nation as a whole. So tax is there as one method that the government have got of raising finance to enable them to do the things they need to do to keep the country running.
And you sent me a fascinating link earlier this week. It was a spreadsheet. Who doesn't love a spreadsheet? But this was the government spreadsheet effectively showing their expenditure account, a breakdown of how they spend that money. And I found it fascinating, Dave. What jumped out on those expenditure lists for you?
Well, firstly, for anyone that is interested, the government publish all this stuff. You just need to know kind of the kind of places to look. So Office for National Statistics is a great place to look for information. Office for Budget Responsibility is another great place to look. HMRC's got loads of information. But you can just Google, you know, what does the government spend all my tax money on? And, you know, there's a few offensive websites, but you'll eventually find the government websites where they publish all of this data, and there is complete transparency over the data that they publish. So when we look at expenditure, our governments are anticipating in 2023, 2024, and I think I sent you some data from an earlier year, but they're anticipating that in this tax year, they will be spending £1.2 trillion on the stuff that we need. So £1.2 trillion. Now, I had to write that out with all the zeros just to kind of get an idea of how big that number is. You know, most of us have come across what a million is. Okay, if we have 1,000 of those millions, that's a billion. If we have 1,000 of those trillions, sorry, of those billions, that's a trillion. So effectively, it's a million, lots of a million pounds that we're spending on the things that this country needs in order to keep going.
And it broke it down. The numbers were really big and mind-boggling, but at least I could use it as a comparison. Really interesting to see how much our government spend on health for the nation. And that was one of the bigger areas of expenditure. And when I looked, they were spending over double the amount on health that they do in education. In our job, my eyes jumped secondly to education, thinking, I wonder how much they spend there. And although the numbers themselves were big, it gave a really good comparison of what they spend the money on relative to other areas.
Absolutely. So health, I'm going to go by the numbers that I've got. And these are anticipated numbers for 2023, 2024. So we haven't yet spent all this money, but we're well on the road to spending it. In terms of health, As a nation, we're spending £176 billion on our National Health Service, which is what, about 10% of our total expenditure. Compared to education, £81 billion. So as you said, about half as much, less than half as much money is spent on our schools, colleges, universities, all the things that the government may fund. compared with our National Health Service. So I thought they were quite big. I was surprised, and you were surprised for an opposite reason, for the defence expenditure. So we're currently spending £32 billion on defence, which is what our army, our air force, our navy. Now, I thought that was quite low, but you thought that was quite high, didn't you?
I did. I thought that was a lot of money to be spending on the armed forces.
It is. I agree. It's a lot of money. It's more money than I'm ever going to see in my lifetime. But I just think that I always think that, you know, the army is a very, very big organization. The navy is a big organization. I think of, you know, aircrafts for the RAF. I think of big battleships, tanks, all the people that are there that are actually fighting, all the people that support it. And I think 32 billion doesn't seem a huge amount when you look at the amount that's spent in the NHS and in the education service, but still a huge amount of money.
Yeah, I guess from my perspective, I was coming at it from the angle of we all use the NHS, we all use the education system. If I personally use the military, I guess no, but maybe that's the wrong way to think about it. But it is certainly something that, particularly when we're coming up to a potential general election, we will be hearing lots more about, won't we? We will be hearing various parties talking about their plans, their manifesto, and how much they would be allocating to each of these different areas.
Absolutely. And it's, health is huge. The kind of other big headline numbers that I've got are £124 billion will be spent this year on the state pension. So £124 billion is being paid to our elderly people that are retired, that are drawing the state pension. £133 billion are being spent by the government on roads and buildings projects. So transportation and infrastructure projects. So massive, massive amounts of money are being spent there. And when we think about, we should reduce the rates of tax. In the short term, reducing rates of tax is going to have an impact on these items of expenditure. And it's probably going to have more of an effect on the larger ones, because they're the ones you can impact more readily. So it does kind of like when people are saying, we should drop the rate of income tax, that means you're going to have to cut state pensions. You know, for old people, and some old people are really struggling to heat their homes at the moment. Or that means we may have to cut expenditure in the National Health Service. And, you know, £176 billion right now. But if you chopped off £30 billion from that, that's, you know, a big, big chunk. That's hospitals. That's, you know, GP surgeries. That's big areas of the country that may not have the services that they need to maintain a healthy population.
And although the numbers are massive and mind-boggling and lots of zeros when you write them out in full, the principle is quite basic accounting, isn't it? It's an income and an expenditure account. And we're going to talk in a moment about tax being one of the big sources of the income for the government. What we're talking about there is the expenditure and effectively balancing those two out. I'm right in thinking, like most things in the world of accountancy, we've got some technical jargon-esque terms. When we read things about fiscal policy or fiscal statements or fiscal years, to me, I just think that's an overly complicated word for tax. Am I simplifying that too much, Dave?
No, not at all. I think that most normal people would talk about taxation and expenditure. Whereas, using the term fiscal policy is just a term that most people don't understand. And the government like to throw it around. I sometimes think they like to throw around terms like that just to seem important, rather than in my classes, I always try to use the simplest possible term to describe something, because I don't want to run the risk that, you know, even if it's one person in the class doesn't understand that term. So I always tend to err on the side of, I'll talk about taxing and spending rather than, you know, examining the fiscal policy of the government.
So another reason I thought this was quite a good time to record the session and release it, we are coming up to something that we've had for a number of years now called the Autumn Statement. The Chancellor of the Exchequer from the elected government releases his or her Autumn Statement. What does the Autumn Statement actually mean, Dave?
The Autumn Statement, from the point of view of most normal people, and I'm including you and I as normal people here, Ben, the autumn statement is when the Chancellor of the Exchequer comes out and tells us what is likely to happen to taxation policy from the next tax year. So we're really looking here from kind of April next year, April 2024, the Chancellor will be setting down now what his expectations are of tax rate changes in the next tax year.
And so that then leads into the budget, as it will Absolutely. Be called in the news, which as a tax tutor, you would call the Finance Act, the legislation yep. actually passes through the government system, is voted yep. for in the House of Lords, House of Commons, and becomes the law, effectively, yep. a piece of legislation.
Yeah, absolutely. And the budget happens kind of beginning part of next year, just before the change of Finance Act. It used to be the case that the budget would be the big announcement when the rates would be discussed and new rules would be introduced. It's now really been brought backwards to kind of this time of year. And that's great for us as accountants because it gives us time to plan. We can see what's happening over the next 5-6 months and we can inform our clients. We can let people know what the change in rules is likely to mean to them and what do they need to do today in order to be in the best position when those rules change.
And I suppose bringing it back to accountancy exams, that's when the examiners for the various tax exams will start thinking, oh, I'm going to have to update some of the tax rules and questions. And that's when our publishing department have to go through and do some quite big updates to tax notes from the course papers.
Absolutely. When we saw the change of corporation tax rates a while ago, where there's a small company rate and a large company rate and then a marginal rate in the middle, some of our technical friends that write the tax manuals got very, very excited because what had been previously a rather slim chapter of the notes on calculating corporation tax suddenly became far more exciting with loads of new things. And something we do know in most tax exams is if there is something new in the syllabus that's arisen as a result of a change in policy or a change in rules, it's going to get examined very quickly because examiners love to test those new rules because it shows students really understand the rules rather than they've just memorized year after year after year of past exam questions where the rules have been unchanged. So anything new that comes into a tax syllabus, I would make sure that you fully understand it going into the exam.
And this is something for students listening to this to be mindful of, making sure that they are actually studying the right tax rules, the right Finance Act variation of the course notes for the exam and the date of the exam they are sitting. I'm not going to go into the details of that because it changes and you might be listening to this in another year, 2 years time. But just please make sure it's always worth reaching out to your training provider, to your tutor, and just making sure for when you're planning to sit your tax exam, the course notes, the question bank, the tasks, the mocks that you've got are relevant for the tax legislation at the time. And increasingly we see, though, don't we, in the exam that students are given some tax rates and tables to use in the exam. The days of having to remember all of this off the top of your head are gone. That said, you do still need to put in the hard yards to practice questions and get used to how to present and calculate your answers.
Yeah, I can't remember a tax exam really where you had to memorize rates. Rates have always historically been given to you. Depending on the exam you do, depends on the amount of information you get. Some exams give you lots of information. Some exams give you quite a lot. If anyone has got the pleasure of doing the ATT exams or CTA exams, they're the tax advisor and tax technician exams, you get access to the full breadth of Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs rules, which is volume upon volume of different acts of Parliament. So absolutely every rule is there. The real art in those exams is knowing how to use the legislation and exactly where to look to look up the tax rules. And definitely ATT level, probably 80% of the exam you'll be able to do without looking at the tax tables, the tax legislation, if you properly prepared for those exams.
So let's have a look at some of the different taxes and the ways our UK government raise that money from individuals and businesses, mostly for this conversation. I'm going to start with VAT, if that's okay, Dave.
Yep.
So VAT, a tax that we all suffer. I can't believe a single person listening to this podcast hasn't actually had to pay some VAT themselves in the last week. It's a tax on transactions. It's a tax on consumer goods. We call it an indirect tax.
Yep.
What's the logic behind indirect tax with regards to the name?
So I always think that you've got two types of tax, direct and indirect. And direct taxes are where tax is directly taken from your income, your wealth. So tax is directly removed from your income for income tax. It's directly taken from corporate profits for corporation tax. Indirect tax is where usually tax is charged indirectly. It's not taken by the government. It's taken by someone else from an amount of money that you spent. So indirect taxes that we see are things like value-added tax, which is the biggest of the indirect taxes. But we also see it on things like stamp duty. And if anyone cares about other taxes, things like airline passenger duty would also be another form of indirect tax. Now, in terms of VAT, I think a lot of us tend to think, oh, VAT isn't that important. When we go into professional exams, particularly ACCA, ICAW, VAT is normally a small bit of a question or a very small question on its own. But VAT, Ben, is the third biggest tax in the UK in terms of the amount of money that the UK government takes. So on the table of taxes, if you want to look it up on the government's website, okay, go number one, number two, number three is value-added tax. And VAT, in terms of the numbers that I'm looking at here, the government are raising roughly £160 billion worth of value-added tax. And value-added tax is a tax on the consumer, the final consumer of those goods, which is going to be us. It's going to be you and I. It's going to be the people in this country that buy stuff. So £160 billion worth of cash. That's nearly enough money to pay for the entire National Health Service. That's enough money to pay for all of our schools, all of our education, and all of our defence.
In my experience, it's one of the more complex taxes. When you actually start getting into the detail of it, there are lots of strange rules, and we're not going to go through those today. But I do feel as consumers, we sometimes, although we all suffer it, sometimes miss it. I know you and your family have holidayed in the USA. We went there this summer, and it was noticeable to us as a family when we went to a supermarket and bought stuff, the price that we actually saw stuff advertised on the shelf, when it went through the till and then they charged us the money, it suddenly jumped up. And we don't see so much of that in the UK. When we go and do our shopping, the price we see it advertised is the price we pay, quite often already including the VAT. But I'd be interested, did you notice that when you were in America?
Yes, I did. It's something that frustrates you. But I understand in America, they have different sales taxes depending on which state you're in. So it will be difficult for a company to say, this is our price all around the country, including a sales tax, because it will be different in Florida to California to New York.
We all suffer it, as I say. There are different rates of VAT, and we're not going to get into the detail of that this evening. But in my very simplistic brain, it is a flat rate for the goods, and it's all based on the value of the goods because it's a percentage of the net value of those goods that we are effectively charged in VAT. I feel old. I, in my head, think initially at 17.5%, quite a strange percentage to think about. But when I was growing up, when I did my exams and study, VAT, the basic VAT rate in the UK, the standard rate was 17.5%. And I looked it up today. It was back in 2011, which in my old brain doesn't seem that long ago that it actually got changed. But for years and years and years, it was 17.5%, which really tested your ability to do percentages on a calculator, because it maybe wasn't quite as simple to do in your head as 20% is a nicer percentage that we see now.
Do you not remember 7 over 40 and 7 over 47?
Yeah, 7/47, all weird and wonderful fractions to come up with the working back from gross to net, net to gross, and so on. But the government can change it. I think sometimes we think, oh, that's just that and it's set, but the government can change it. And they did during COVID, didn't they? They reduced it for some meals, eating out, hospitality. What? Why would a government potentially look to reduce the rate of VAT on things like that, Dave?
The VAT, as you said, it affects everyone that spends money. But it also, it impacts people on lower incomes more than it impacts people on higher incomes. So in general, the principle would be that if you're on a very low income, in order to survive, you have to spend virtually all of your income. If you're on a very high income, you don't need to spend as much of your income, and you may choose to save or to invest some of your money. So if you put VAT rates up, then if you're spending all of your income on stuff, then that's going to impact the price of everything that you purchase. Whereas if you're super rich and you spend only a small amount of your income on your day-to-day expenditure, a little bit of an increase doesn't affect you quite so much. So what we were doing by reducing VAT rates, bringing them down from 20% to 15%, just meant that things weren't quite so expensive. So if you wanted to go out with your family and you're on a relatively low income, it became more affordable for you. So it meant that, oh, actually, I can afford to go out because it's that little bit cheaper. Or maybe after I've gone out, I've got a little bit more money left over so I can choose to spend it somewhere else. And that's what the government were trying to encourage, is people to spend more money and do more things. So reducing VAT made those goods cheaper. So for those people that were going to expend money, where maybe they weren't able to because they didn't have enough money with those higher rates, they were able to buy more things.
I think it's right to be aware that at any point the government could change the standard rate of VAT, and they have done in the past. As I say, we are old enough to have experienced that. I seem to remember they went for after 17.5%, it went, did it go 15% and then back up to 20%? And I believe they chose New Year's Eve as the night that they would bring in the legislation. My recollection is when the government announced this, they put it through pretty quickly because they know there might be some implications if people are aware too far in advance that the rate is changing. And I believe they picked the 31st of December to change it.
You're absolutely right. It is one of those taxes that when it's announced there's a change, it happens almost immediately, because if not, you're absolutely right, it's going to impact people's behavior. And government don't want people either all piling in to buy something or stopping purchasing something because the rate's changing. So if you knew that the rate of VAT was going to be lower in 2 months' time than it is right now, you'd probably hold back buying goods because you want to buy them when the VAT is cheaper and the goods are cheaper to you. If you know the rates are going up, you want to buy everything now. And that causes distortions in the market, distortions throughout the economy.
I suppose the other thing on VAT before we move on and talk about some of the other taxes is we've talked about the potential change in the percentage rate. But there are things that are standard rated goods. There are things that are zero rated goods. There are things that are the reduced rate, because there is a 5% VAT rate in the UK. And I guess that's the other aspect that governments could take. They could maybe reclassify goods and services to move them to a different rate of VAT.
Yeah, absolutely. It's something that, until we left the European Union, was very, very difficult for us to do. It's now far easier for the UK government to move something to becoming exempt or becoming zero rated. So it is definitely something we can do. The government haven't done a huge amount of it, as I've seen. Although I know that there are pressures on the government to reduce the rate of VAT for certain sanitary products, which I think is right and proper and probably should happen sooner rather than later. We're yet to see if there'll be anything else that will get that treatment.
Let's move on. Let's pick our second tax of the evening. And this is the biggest earner for the UK government presently: income tax. Talk to us about income tax, Dave.
249 billion UK pounds raised through income tax. Huge amount of money. That is roughly just under a quarter of government expenditure in the UK. So a quarter of government expenditure comes from the income tax that we pay on our salaries. That would pay for all of our hospitals, all of our NHS. It actually would pay for almost all of our hospitals, all of our NHS, and all of our schools. So it's a massive, massive amount of cash that's raised through income tax. Now, income tax is one of the taxes in the UK that we would refer to as a progressive tax. And Ben, you know what a progressive tax is, don't you?
I usually use income tax as my example when I'm explaining a progressive tax. It's all about the rate increasing as income goes up. That's right, isn't it, Dave?
Absolutely right. Yep. So in the UK, we have stepped rates of income tax. You have a personal allowance. Everyone gets that. So you get paid nothing on that, paid tax on at a zero rate on that first lump of income. And then everything after that is taxed at what rate, Ben?
20%.
20%. Perfect. You earn a load of income and pay tax on it at 20%. And then it jumps up to
40% currently, Dave.
Perfect. Then it goes up and up and up and up and up. And then you get taxed at a higher rate of?
Currently 45, but has been 50% in recent memory. And
Absolutely.
Going back to the 1970s, before both me and you were born, probably, there was even higher rates in the UK than that, wasn't there?
Yes. Yeah, there were very, very high rates of tax. But we still have some really funny situations where tax rates are actually higher than 45%, although they're never advertised at that. So there are funny bands of tax. So if you earn just over £100,000, if you're fortunate enough to earn that money, you start getting a reduction in your zero rate band, which pulls all of your tax bands down, means you end up paying, yes, the 40% tax for earning a pound over £100,000, but also because you lose some of that 0% band, the effective rate of tax actually ends up being at 60%. And there's an even worse band of tax, Ben, if you are a parent who claims the child allowance. You get that reduced over, I think it's when you're earning about £40,000 or £50,000, and that amount of allowance gets restricted for every pound that you earn, plus you're paying tax at 40%. And I believe the tax rate in that particular band is even more, and it's even worse if you are a graduate who has to repay a student loan in that tax band. And I believe you can end up paying tax or effectively getting deductions of kind of 90% plus from your income if you're in that particular band. So there are some oddities in there, but in general, you're absolutely right. It's zero, it's 20, it's 40, it's 45%.
And you've been doing some research into this. Where does that average out? So the average percentage that a UK citizen is paying income tax, where does that fall?
The average rate, so if you take the total amount of income tax and the total amount of earnings that people have through PAYE and self-employment and things like that, and you divide one by the other, the average amount of, or average rate of tax that we're paying in the UK is an average of 24%. So effectively, for every single percentage point in our taxation system, that's £10 billion worth of tax that are being raised. So if the government put the average tax rate up by 1%, so it goes from 0% to 1, 20 to 21, and so on, then you would expect them to raise an extra £10 billion, which pays for a third of our defence forces. So we've got three key defence forces. That probably pays for the entire Royal Navy.
Wow. And the government can come at this from lots of different angles. Because it's a progressive tax and there are different rates and bandings, over the years, governments have tried different ways to play around with those rates and bandings, haven't they? So let's talk about personal allowance first. That's a common thing that will be talked about, announced in autumn statements and budgets, and maybe in different party manifestos. But the government can effectively change the personal allowance, which is effectively the amount of earnings before any one of us would pay tax.
Agreed. Yep. They can do that. If we go back about 10 years, the government went through a process of raising that personal allowance at very high rates to pull more and more people out of paying tax if they had low incomes. And from my perspective, I thought that was a really, really good thing. I think that the people that need most help from our taxation system are people that are on low incomes. By increasing that personal allowance, it meant that people on low incomes got to keep more of the money that they earned. Everyone benefits from that. So everyone gets the same benefits. But if you were earning, say, £10,000 because you were working part-time, you get to keep all of that money, no tax at all. Yes, someone earning £90,000 would get exactly the same tax break, which I think is fair because people are treated fairly, but they don't benefit from it in the same way as someone that got to keep all their income. So for them, it proportionally doesn't help them quite as much.
The next big one is the basic rate. I presume the basic rate percentage would affect the most taxpayers because that's the rate that effectively everybody who is paying tax is going to pay some of their tax at that basic rate. And what we tend to hear people talk in the news, in the mainstream media, about changing the rate by 1 pence in the pound, which I always think is a bit of a cop out. That's effectively 1%, isn't it? 1p in the pound, 100 pence is a 1% change. But the one that more recent chancellors and governments have looked at is the higher rate of tax, and really looking at whether that could be increased or maybe reduced. And I think there are economic arguments for that one either way.
There are. There's the argument that some people would have is that if we put up the higher rates of tax, it means the people that can afford it, who are on a higher income, are paying a little bit more tax. That raises more money for the country. People on lower incomes don't get hit by it because they don't earn that money. So there's a very good argument to say, yes, you put rates of tax up there, then it will just raise more money for the exchequer, for public services, and it doesn't harm working people that are really struggling. Now, the flip side of that is that people will also argue that if you tax rich people too much, rich people have got lots of assets, lots of money, lots of wealth, and it's very easy for them to take their money, assets and wealth, put it on a plane and fly out of the UK and go and live somewhere with a lower rate of taxation. And we have seen that with, shall we say, some of our higher earning celebrities. So I believe, and I'm not 100% sure, so this may need to be fact checked, but I believe that Lewis Hamilton doesn't live in the UK anymore, does he, Ben?
I believe that to be the case, and not just him. There are plenty of celebrities traditionally, that there's lots of examples of pop and rock groups that have conveniently left the UK, so they are not classed as residents in years that they know their incomes are going to be really high because maybe they're releasing an album.
Absolutely. We've seen many, many bands having world tours that happen to span an entire tax year, so they can be absent for the tax year and not resident for that tax year and not pay tax in the way that you or I would on their large amounts of income for their tour or for their album.
And we've also had other things where it maybe has discouraged people coming to the UK for various events. I think there were some exceptions made for sporting events a while ago with regards to earnings that they would earn during those. And it's a really interesting subject, and one that very hard to come up with a right and wrong answer. So I do pity the government from that perspective and all of their statisticians that would try to predict and model what might happen overall with a change to those higher rates of income tax. I'm going to move it on because I'm conscious of time. But the one that really surprised me, actually, when we looked at the stats that you sent over, was the one that was the second biggest source of tax income for the UK government. And that was national insurance, which I always think is maybe a bit of a second fiddle tax to income tax, but it is a big revenue generator for the government.
It's a huge revenue generator, £178 billion. That is enough money to fund the entire NHS. So it's a huge amount of money that we raise through national insurance. And I think the reason that you don't think of it as being a big tax is, one, it's more simple than income tax, so you spend less time looking at it. And secondly, national insurance has got two elements. It's got the amount that we have deducted from our salary, but also it has an amount that our employer pays because they employ us. So there's employers and employees' national insurance contributions. And for normal people, when we're talking about basic rate taxpayers. Basic rate taxpayers, when you combine the employer's contribution and the employee's contribution, you're looking at a rate of about 25%, which is pretty close to that average rate of income tax that we had. So it's understandable why it's up there as kind of tax number two. Okay, so you've got income tax number one, national insurance number two, VAT number three, all taxes suffered by us, people that work, people that are self-employed, people that spend money. But yeah, 178 billion, huge.
And national insurance has been controversial in the headlines in recent years. There was a move to try and level it up between the employed and the self-employed. And there was a backlash on that when the government announced it. But more recently, they brought it back to, my understanding of national insurance initially was, in the old days, my mum would have called it paying the stamp, I think. Yep. And it was meant to be revenue that the government generated to fund social support for people, was my understanding. So it would in part fund pension contributions. And there's lots of confusion there about whether you could opt out or opt in the old days and whether that would impact on your state pension. And you mentioned earlier the amount of money that the government are continuing to pay out every year in state pension. But more recently, the government have said they want to use it to support the NHS, because I think they know that the vast majority of people in the UK are really grateful for having the National Health Service. And if they feel their money is going towards that, are probably a bit more willing to say we would support a tax rise if we knew it was going to pay the doctors, the nurses and all the brilliant medical professionals that we can access.
Yeah, it is something that our government have tried to do, calling it a levy or something like that, and then effectively wrapping it up with national insurance. National insurance is something that when you pay your national insurance contributions, it gives you entitlement to certain welfare benefits. And the number one that you mentioned there, Ben, is the pension, the state pension. If you make enough annual contributions to national insurance over your working life, you will be entitled to the full state pension when you retire. It also entitles you to things like unemployment benefits. So there are other benefits that you would be entitled to if you've made sufficient payments under national insurance contributions. If you haven't made sufficient payments under national insurance contributions, you can actually volunteer to pay some extra national insurance to top your level of national insurance up to ensure that you do get the full state pension when you retire.
I want to move on and talk about another one, because it's one that I think we might be hearing again, because it tends to come out around election time with regards to should the government do something different with the rate of capital gains tax for individuals. This potentially can create some confusion that capital gains tax paid on selling of assets. But at the moment in the UK, and forgive me if I'm wrong here, but my understanding is the rate percentage wise is different to the rate that the individual would pay if it was classed as income that they'd earn.
Yes. Yeah. So in terms of capital taxes in general, and this is capital gains tax and also things like inheritance tax, you're looking at a total tax take by the UK government of about £83 billion. So it's much, much lower than the other ones we've talked about. It's just about enough money to fund our schools. Okay, it's enough to fund our defence services more than twice over. But in context, it's half as much as VAT. It's less than half of national insurance. It's about a third of income tax. So it's nowhere near that much. And capital gains tax is one of those. So it's a relatively small tax, but it's one that upsets people loads in the same way that inheritance tax upsets people loads. And I think that's why governments look at them, because they know that they can make political capital out of talking about them. So capital gains tax, you're absolutely right. If you sell an asset and you make a profit, so you've made an investment, you've bought some shares and you've sold them and you've made a profit, you will pay tax at a lower rate than if someone earns that money through salary or through carrying out a trade. And there is a lot of talk about should those things be equalized or not. And I don't think it's as easy as saying yes or no. I know that there are some people out there that make it almost a game out of trying to classify earnings that they've made as capital gains in order to minimize their exposure to income tax and pay capital gains tax instead. And historically, this happened a lot with people that renovated and bought and sold property. They would almost be carrying out a trade of buying properties, doing them up, selling them, making a profit, and then recording it as a gain rather than income. But we know the government have got a little bit wise to that. They've increased the rate of capital gains tax for property sales, and they've also made it more difficult to record those gains as income. However, I do think there is a place to give a lower rate of tax to those people that have taken risks to set up and run their own business. I think for entrepreneurs out there, to say to an entrepreneur, you know, if you invest your own money and you risk your own money setting up a business, if it's successful because you've worked hard and your team have worked hard and you sell it after 10, 15, 20 years and make a gain, I think there's a real argument to say that if you reward them with a low rate of tax, it will encourage entrepreneurism. It will encourage people to set up their own businesses. So I think there is an argument to say that capital taxes, or capital gains tax, I should say, should be at a lower rate for those kind of things. And we have got some reliefs around that. But I also can see the argument for stopping people playing silly games, trying to hide income and pretend it's a gain.
That's a real controversial one, and I'm sure we will be hearing more about that in the coming months as we head into an election, because it's one that's talked about a lot.
Yep.
The world of corporation tax is the final one I wanted to talk about. I'm conscious of timing. Corporation tax does away with that because, as far as I understand it, if a company makes a capital gain or it earns it as profit, it pays the same rate of tax on both of those. So they have got a bit of precedent for saying for companies, there is not this differential between capital gains and effectively profit trading income. But corporation tax is the fourth biggest generator for the UK in tax take. And I think in my head, it's the one that's probably got more international aspects than some of the other ones. You talked maybe about the super rich having a bit of a choice as to where they live, but we know companies can be attracted to the UK to come and set up their offices here. And also they can potentially leave the UK and go and take all of that other benefit of employment and other services they provide by relocating overseas. Do you think there is an element of international comparison there with corporation tax more than some of the other taxes?
Yes, there is. Absolutely. In terms of corporate tax, you've seen this happen, Ben, because you live in Cambridge. And a few years ago, the UK reduced the rates of corporation tax quite significantly and got them down as low as 19%. As a result of that, we saw overseas companies that had headquarters overseas coming to the UK. And in Cambridge, you saw AstraZeneca. And AstraZeneca relocated to the UK, moved their head office to the UK, are one of the biggest companies in the FTSE 100. So a huge, huge business. It was always a UK business, then had moved abroad, then it came back to the UK. And it was lured to the UK because it became more attractive from a financial perspective. So we've seen companies like AstraZeneca come to the UK and decide they want to be part of the UK. And the thing that you noticed, I know, Ben, because you're an accountant, and in Cambridge, they relocated the headquarters. They need to recruit an entirely new finance team. And there was a massive shortage of accountants because AstraZeneca came to town saying, we're recruiting, and there weren't enough accountants in the area. So they bring jobs with them when they come to the UK. We also know that companies will look to move abroad if they can find a lower rate of tax. And it's a favourable operating condition as well. So HSBC, which is, I think, still the biggest company in the FTSE 100s, has its banking headquarters in the City of London. And they are always talking about, are they going to move overseas? Because overseas tax rates are lower. If they can find somewhere that is as good in terms of the infrastructure to be based in, I'm sure they'll move to a lower tax jurisdiction if they can. But we do have a huge benefit of a massive centre of excellence of banking within the City of London, which may hold them there. But if the rates went up kind of like to 25, 30, 35, 40%, they're probably going to look elsewhere. So big companies will. However, most of our economy, Ben, is based on small businesses. You know, most people work for small businesses. And, you know, is the small printing company down the road going to, you know, offshore to Germany because tax rates are cheaper in Germany? You know, is your cleaning company that cleans your offices, you know, at night, are they suddenly going to move to Switzerland because the rates are cheaper? So I think for small businesses, it's not such an issue. But for those big multinationals, absolutely, they will be moving to wherever is the most favourable place for them to be based.
And we have seen an element of government response to this. So when I was studying, and certainly when I was in practice, we did have different rates of corporation tax, and we had a marginal rate in the middle, which was really quite complex and complicated to work out. And then it really got simplified a few years back, where it was just a flat rate. So whether you were AstraZeneca or your local electrician that was trading as a limited company, they would pay the same percentage rate of tax. But that has more recently changed, hasn't it, Dave? We have now got a dual rate of tax. So the larger profit-making businesses pay a higher percentage of their profits in tax under corporation tax.
Absolutely. So they're paying tax at a rate of 25%. So it has gone up significantly for those larger companies. And that's one of the concerns, I think, that some people have. And I know Liz Truss, when she was Prime Minister, very briefly, she was very concerned about the fact that UK businesses would leave the UK if the rate of tax went up to 25%. And she, in her mini budget, as they call it, which was anything but a mini budget, it was a massive budget, she actually scrapped that rise, but she wasn't long enough to actually see the scrapping take place. But that was one of the things she was worried about, and she wanted to encourage companies to be operating in the UK in a low tax jurisdiction.
Dave, I'm going to say we need to wrap up now because we are over time on this evening's session. Thank you so much. Your knowledge always is exceptional. You've given us lots of information there, a lot of it relevant to studies, but also relevant for our own lives and thinking about, we are going to be hearing lots of stuff on the news about different parties looking for our vote in the next general election. And I hope tonight has given you a bit of a thought to maybe go and look into things a bit more before you go and cast your vote in a general election, if we get one as predicted next year, to think about the implications for what people are saying in manifestos about taxation. Any final thoughts from you, Dave?
I would urge people to look at what the government spend their money on and realise the amounts of money that are involved, because they are huge and there are very, very significant items there. And, you know, when people talk about, is a certain item of expenditure that the government are putting forward funded, well, what they mean is, we're going to add an extra 200 billion onto the expenditure list. Where's the income coming from? And we know the big, big taxes are the ones that we all pay. So income tax, national insurance contributions, VAT, they're the ones that have got the scope for, you know, a 2 percentage point change can add an extra 50 billion in the pot. So are we prepared to pay those kind of extra tax increases in order to get those additional things that the government are proposing? Likewise, if a government says we're going to cut taxation, well, what are they going to take off that list? Is there something there that's going to disappear? And if they're saying that we're going to cut tax, and we can work out that tax cut is going to equate to £30 billion, we suddenly don't have any defence forces left. You know, that's the kind of cut that you would need to make, is a Royal Navy, a Royal Air Force and an army all disappearing. That's the scope of the cuts that maybe a 2% change of income tax would lead on to.
We will see. We will see. Tax will continue to evolve. What do they say? There are two things in life that are certain: death and taxes. Well, we've talked about tax this evening, and it will continue to be a source of discussion, both in the classroom, but also in the local community, the societies that you live in. So go and find out and look into it a bit more.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to the FI podcast with your hosts, Ben and Dave.
As always, you can head over to the show notes, where you can find the links and resources spoken about in today's episode.
Please remember to follow the podcast so you don't miss an episode, and leave a rating and review.